Mr. Holsworth 309. So, by the early 60s, you decided there wasn't a lot that could be done.
There was a lot, not a lot could be done. And so you just, I mean, we'd seen this coming, the 68 thing, and we knew there was. And I started working in Intex 72. And I'd been, while I was working on the machines, I'd been thinking over where we went wrong. And I got this theory, I mean, real economism, that the party had replaced the class, had usurped the position of the class, that the class had to make the revolution. The party couldn't do it by itself. The class had to do it. So what to do was teach the workers how to fight. That was what I had to do. Anyway, the problems that this arose in Intex because of this soon, you know, tested the theory. So I could see the whole place was in, you know, it was a closed shop enforced by management. They got everybody in the canteen and said, those that don't want to join Dyes and Bleachers can pick up the P-45s on the way out of the canteen. So it was a closed shop by Dyes and Bleachers. They'd seen three unions and they'd given the lowest terms. They used to meet, the manager used to meet with the district organiser of Dyes and Bleachers. Every year in a hotel they'd have a meal and then bring out a new wage agreement, which would be 30 bob more, £1.50. But we'd have another machine. And by this time, we're working more machines than anyone else in Europe. 3.5 machines of 20 denier, the finest denier. And, I mean, the Turkish workers in Germany were only working 3 machines. The French workers were working 2. The Dutch workers were working 1.5. We were working 3.5. We were known as the Intex Coolies. And they devastated ICI that had taken over Intex. They were the real owners. They devastated the French and German crimping industry. The German had a third of the warehouses full of stock they couldn't sell, and the French had a half. The Netherlands people were complaining that ICI was shipping made-up cloth. They used to make it into a stocking, knit it into a stocking, and then they'd dye it and then unwind the stocking, you see, ready for making into whatever they made it into then. That they were selling this cloth cheaper than they could buy the unprocessed yarn. So, I mean, they were mangling them. And 60% of the workers were Asians, and they were really, they'd really got this white against Asians. The language difficulty made the whites very suspicious of what they were talking about, because they spoke in Punjabi when they spoke with each other, mainly Pakistani. Although Urdu is a language, they mainly speak in Punjabi, simpler language. And it's, I mean, the shop stewards were all white, and it was a line of promotion. Shop steward, charjan, foreman. 80% of the charjans, and I think it was just under 60% of the foremen, were ex-militant shop stewards. They'd drawn them up. And our shop steward, and then the crimping on B shift, I was on B shift, was completely hopeless. He was really in the management's pocket. Anyway, the last, when I caught onto it, I thought, well, I've been puzzling how to do it, how to organise and how to start fighting. I'd set my face against racism. I wouldn't accept any racism at all. I'd stop every racist joke and say that it was a racist joke and it was dividing us. If we were going to get better conditions there, we had to unite, we'd got to come together. So we had to fight against any of these bosses' techniques for disuniting us. So, and racism was one of the tools they used. Like, and also the women, we had to get unity with the women. Of course they were frightened, more so than us, because their shifts were tied with leaving the kids and then picking them up, see? So we got to, unity was the main thing for us in the factory, unity against the boss. His interests were the opposite of ours. Basic trade unionism. And I said, and we've got to renege on what our shop stewards are doing. We've got to let the boss know that he can make whatever agreements he likes with them, or we'll renege on them. So, sure enough, they got another half machine. So we said, well, he can run it. He agreed to it. So the shop stewards that agreed to it can run it. We'll not touch it. So we left all these half machines, and he was rushing about trying to keep them up, and they all fell to bits, and they had to scrub it, you see. So I said, we've got to get them out. So we've got to put people up against them. And I talked to the blacks and said, we need Asian shop stewards, people that can speak the language, so they can discuss with you what we're discussing, you know, our tactics and strategy for bettering things in the factory. And we got rid of the steward, and I put forward there was this hard lad on our shift, a real tough lad, so I backed him as shop steward, and we got rid of this. Oh, we had an Asian shop steward, first of all, and he was completely rubbish, Mr. Fix-It. And I used to say to him whenever I saw him in the canteen or anything, you know, resign, you bum. Anyway, he resigned, finally. And so we got this militant as a shop steward, and he was quite good. He was really tough with the boss and all that. But Zaman, the leader of the Asians, they tried to work a flanker on him, the management. See, every 6 weeks the machines were stopped. Singly, they'd stop a machine and clean it and then start it up again, what they call gating it up. They had a team came in specially on overtime to gate the thing up, to put all the ends up. When it was up and running, then you'd take it over, see? So, if one of your machines was stopped for cleaning, it was a bonus. You only had two machines to work, see? So they said, because his other machines were straight, he could gate this up in between. So we said, no way, don't do it. Now, and also at the same time, I'd been reading Private Eye, one of the lads that brought Private Eye, and it had a tear out for subscription to Socialist Worker. So I took out a subscription for Socialist Worker. So I used to get that every week and pass it round, let another couple of guys read it. Anyway, Zaman refused. So they brought the boss in, and he was up before the boss, and the boss ordered him to do it, and refused again, because we were telling him, refuse. So they sacked him, and they had a charge, and they escorted him off the premises. So I went in the smoke box, and we had a separate room, which we called the smoke box, where he could go for a smoke. And this steward of ours was seeing the management, you see. And when I went in, they were all looking at me hot-eyed, well, what about it, Dave? So I said, well, I think we should get our coats on, and we'll follow him out, and we'll follow him back in. Follow Zaman out, and follow Zaman back in. And they all started getting their coats on. You see, and that was when it brought the crunch, this theory of mine about pushing the workers to lead. Because when it came to the crunch, I led. Now, we'd elected this other guy, though. And it wasn't him leading at all. So I was splitting the thing. He was being separated. Of course, he felt pissed off at this, you know. Anyway, he was trying to physically stop me from leaving, you know, the premises. Anyway, we argued with him, and he came with us. We came back here. We set this up a strike committee, headquarters. And we said, right, we'll put a picket on. It was Friday night. We'll put a picket on Saturday morning when all the fitters come in, because they come in Saturday morning for overtime. And then we'll go to Radcliffe and put a picket on there, you see. So the next morning we put a picket on. We picketed during the night and that. We brought the other shifts out. And in the morning the fitters tried to come in. So I said, formal. 5 or 6 deep across the gates. So they were driving straight up in the cars, and I was like, "Hold!" And they drive straight up to me, all their eyes hot, you know. And I said, "No, park down this street. You're not coming on the car park." And I said, "We're on strike. You know, we're asking you not to cross the picket line." So they said, "Well, we're crossing it." So I said, "Well, you'll have to fight your way across it, because we're not going to let you. If you're prepared to fight your way into work, well, you know, all fair enough, have a go." So two tried to, and they got thumped to the ground, you see. So this electrician then said, "Well, I've never bloody fought my way into work yet, and I'm not going to start, you know." So they went home. So we'd won that. Monday morning, some went up to Radcliffe, and they said the supporters were, but they wouldn't come out. What had happened there? They had black shifts and white shifts. One of the Asian shifts had struck over something, and they'd sacked them all and got the white shifts to scab, covered for them, and then got a new crew altogether. So they were, it was the black shift we went to see. And so they weren't prepared to do anything, although they supported us and were prepared to support us financially and that. So we went Monday morning, and the women were coming in then, and it was raining. Oh, and on the Saturday morning, Eddie Haig, who is now General Secretary of the textile side of T&G, Eddie Haig, he's the one that was mentioned in this Labour Party meeting this week, who voted against Kinnock, you know. Eddie Haig turned up, and we said, "We don't need you, brother. When we need you, we'll send for you. We've got this guy where we want him. The machines are stopping. So, you know, you're a bit superfluous to our needs at the moment. This, we'll soon have this over. But if we get in difficulties, then we're calling you." So, in this situation, he had no option but to clear off, you see. Turned up again Monday morning. We held the women out. They sent the women charge hands out, who were motherly figures, to try and come in last, you know, and all this. We held them out there under umbrellas, though. But then the union entered, Eddie Haig. He said, "Well, we ought to call this meeting at the church down the road, church hall down the road, the Catholic church hall." He said, we're like novices, agreed to it. They'd agreed to have him back, though. But we said we wanted paying for the time we were off, because they'd broken procedures sort of thing, so they couldn't pay for it. Anyway, they wouldn't. When we got to the meeting hall, they were trying to turn back, so I said, "We can't. That's what it's all for, to isolate us, you see. We've got to go in." So we went in. We could see it was a setup. Intex had ordered every taxi in Ashton to go around and bring all those that weren't working and hadn't been involved in the strike to this meeting. So it was packed. They had everybody there. But all the rest of the staff had kept out as well, inspection, all the other people. First time, because it was, they were a bit pissed off with things, you know. And so we would like the spark that set it all off. So I saw the way things were. So I stood up and I said, "Well, we know what our position is. But however, if the vote at this meeting goes against our position, we've got to go along with the majority. If we're for democracy, we've got to accept the majority vote. So if they vote to go back, we've got to go back. We've won the main thing, which was to get Zaman back. You know, we've successfully stopped this victimisation. But we don't want to be isolated, because I could see the danger was they'd all go back and we'd be out. And we'd stay out then, you know, they'd just get rid of. So there was a lot said, oh, bloody turncoat and all this. But, I mean, it was a foregone conclusion. They were going to vote us to go back. All these that had never come out were voting. So they voted to go back. So we went back and we held them and all went back together. Well, we set up a different regime in the factory then. But then they started to organise against us. All these scurrilous rumours were being put about B-shift bully boys, you know. With a few shepherds and all the rest were sheep, sort of thing. But we were talking to the Asians on the other ships, and they started electing Asian shop stewards. And so they were wanting to crush it. Anyway, Two of the lads said, are we going to this Shrewsbury meeting? These two that I'd let this socialist worker do. So I said, what's this? So they said, it advertised this meeting with the Shrewsbury pickets in. So we went down and that's how we met socialist worker, the IS. And they agreed to do us a bulletin. But we said we were going to do a V-shift bulletin explaining ourselves to the shop and what we were stood for. We put it that, you've heard all these rumours about these V-shift boys and want to close the factory down. Well, I mean, we're like the rest of you. We feel we're being, screwed down. And it's about time we started getting, things organised and better. And we're also against the racism, that's rife in the factory. How is it there's no line of promotion for the blacks? Are they saying that there's no black to compare to foreman so-and-so? We said, which everybody laughed at. And he tried to say it as though he was the ideal type of foreman, that they could take the measure of. But he knew what we meant. And that it's about we've lost control of the union. We've got to start going to the union branch. And, it's our organ, it's our union. We've got to take it over and get it working for us. It only met once a year, every March. So we got them to print this and print it in Urdu as well. Bus driver in Blackburn translated it for us. So we were the first in the factory to put Address the Blacks, see? And it was quite, it had quite an impact. And the management started looking at this, that they'd have to start learning Gujarati and Urdu. And we forestalled this thing. And they all used to read it. And I edited the thing. And now it was like comedy as well. I mean, but it was answering the bosses. The bosses said, I see I didn't own it. That was the first line. So we got from the Board of Trade the shareholding, which was 28 million, so many hundred thousand, owned by ICI, and one share on each of the three directors, you see, Intex directors. So we said, I don't know, from the figures it looks as though ICI seems to have the slight majority. And then they said they weren't making a profit, they were just breaking even. We'd also said we'd renege on any agreement that the shop steward made, and if management wanted to put in the proposals, they had to do as a shop floor. So we used to meet management as a shop floor. And they said that they weren't making a profit. So we got the figures from the Board of Trade again. We showed they were making 3.5 million net, 4.5 million gross. ICI profits were only 300 million. We were certainly less than 100th part of the ICI empire. We were making 3.5 million net profits. And it was funny, the boss had us in, the manager. Had us into his office. And they were trying to split us up floor by floor. We're on three floors, you see. And us on the second floor, we're on 30 bob, £1.50, more than them on the third floor. And I said, it's just you're just trying to divide us by this. We're not doing any more work than them. Yeah, we're getting 30 bob a week more money. So you're creating a differential between us. I said, tell you what, I'll put it to the vote here. We'll give you 10 bob, 50p, and we'll give them 50p, and then we'll be even. We'll be a quid worse off, and they'll be 50p better off, so we'll be on the same money as the third floor. So I said, I'll put it to the vote. So it was carried unanimously, see. So he refused it, the manager. So I said, you're just trying to split us, because it's divide and rule, see. Oh, no, it isn't. No, it didn't. And they had this this bonus. I demanded to know how they worked out this bonus. So he brought these pages of figures worked out by the O&M people. Well, they were bullshit figures. They knew we couldn't understand them. So I said, well, I must be really thick. I said, because I can't understand. Would you explain them to me, Mr. Waxfield? Well, I used to call him Maxwell, because he used to say, Maxwell's instant dispute, you see. He was called Maxfield, but I could never remember him. I used to always call him Maxwell, and everybody started calling him Maxwell then, he was really annoying. And he said, well, it's quite simple. And then he started. and then realised that he couldn't make head and tail of them because they were just bullshit figures, you see. They used to guess. So they withdrew that, and then they tried to get us on new shifts. And we said, well, we'll have to work them, so we'll decide what type of shifts we work. We're not doing your shifts. We'll do our type of shifts. And as long as it's covered, what's it got to do with you? You know, you'll get 7 days' work every fortnight. So we went on 12-hour shifts, three on, four off. Three on, four off, four on, three off, you know. So we had 1 week, we only worked 1 weekend in three, because we had to work the system they had. We'd only get 1 week off in every four. No, it was bloody rubbish. So, and we said we want to do away with clocking on, clocking off. This Victorian antiquated thing. The machines are running continuous. We kept them going. Why should we get penalised for clocking on late when we'd still have that same amount of work to do? If we were late, we had to catch up. And we thought it was a Victorian thing. We wanted rid of this clock. And we wanted brewing up points on every floor too. Why should we have to traipse down to the canteen? Well, they're all impossible, we said. And we got them all, you know. And we were on £20 a week more than the other textile mills all around us. So, I mean, we were really getting somewhere. But they sacked Maxwell and got rid of him. And brought in this Jones from Organisation and Methods in Pontypool. And he came. And he kept a real distance. Ran through other people. And the Chargians went to see the leader of the Asian contingents, Shah, and Zaman, him that had been victimised. And they said, there's going to be a white man strike in about 5 or 6 weeks. And if they said to the Pakistanis, who were the majority, if you keep out of it, we'll see you're all right for overtime and, you know, days off, plenty of overtime and that. And they said to Shah for the Indians, if you don't keep your people out of it, we'll sack you. So they both went off on the sick. And we only found out by accident. And then the charge end and foreman of my shift started sabotaging my machines. As soon as we went for a meal, they'd go ahead and knock all the ends down. I'd come back and they were devastated. One of the guys on C shifts saw them doing it, in one overtime, saw them doing it, and were frightened and went on the sick. Management were putting it out that I was doing it myself, you know, to disrupt production. And they'd sent these lads, they'd closed down this firm in Glossop, and they'd taken them on there, hoping to dilute us, so they'd all come on our shift. But they all had quite a strong trade union tradition. And actually, they enhanced us, you know. We had some where you could talk hard to them and they'd follow, you know, understand what was on. We had a guy who came straight from the police force into the thing, and we had a guy who came from army intelligence into the factory at the same time. Well, we were getting a bit worried. And one from SAS. I mean, it was a coincidence, but it was a strange coincidence. And this went on for 6 weeks, sabotaging my machines. I lost 2 stone in weight, you know. And they kept giving me warnings for leaving my machines in the state. I couldn't get them, hopeless trying to get them all back again. Anyway, Zaman broke the news. And I joined IS by this time. And we got 2 or 3 more people with us. There was about 5 of us in IS, although they weren't very political. But we got Zaman to make a statement and Shah to make a statement, which they signed. And the boss had me up. And what they wanted to do was move me in inspection. I'd have been on the same money, so I'd have been the best paid inspector, you see, which was the best job there. But they would move me out of the way. And so I was getting delegations from the Asian shifts, where there were Asian shop stewards, rather, saying, don't leave crimping, Dave. You know, stick to it. So when the boss said, you've got to go to it, and I turned it down, then they sacked me. And they brought these statements out and said, you know, what about these? You know, this has all been put up, all this strike and all that. And he ignored it. So they came out, B shift on strike, and I was escorted off the premises. And then they put it to A shift and A shift came off. Then they put it to C shift and C shift came out. Then they put it to D shift. Now D shift had a National Front cell on. And the majority of them stayed in. Now also the labourers, one of them was a National Fronter. But he came out, but told his people to stay in, there was going to be a lot of trouble. Because by then it was got quite well known that it was a combined white and Asian fighting together. And we'd had United Typewriters and Monesti Fibres in the Midlands, where it had been anti-racist, you know, where it was racist strikes. United Typewriters, the TNG, was coming out with all sorts of racist stuff. And so there was quite a lot of attention on it in the
Is
front.
Is that the Imperial one?
Imperial Typewriters, yeah. That was real racist. They had a racist march, you know, against the black workers. And Monesti was the same. And they had a lot of small ones. So this was the first one where we'd had, I mean, it showed it could be done, you know, that you could fight racism in the factory. At least it drove it underground. It didn't rear its head. Racial jokes were stopped. I mean, we had a case where Ronnie Pike, who was the leader of this fascist cell, I mean, there was this Sadiq who was an obnoxious sod. He used to really get up your nose on C shift with Ronnie Pike, and they'd had some argument. And Ronnie Pike had followed him onto the car park, and when he got opening his door, Ronnie Pike had said, "Take this, you black bastard," and thumped him on, you see. So we were coming on shift, B shift, and all the Asians had come back in, and we're talking to B shift and that. And Pike was quite a charismatic guy, quite well liked with the whites, and quite a few of the blacks. But Sadiq was this bit of an arsehole. But I mean, this was racial connotations. The Asians could certainly see this. So I came onto the shift and they were all in an uproar. So I said, let's all go to the smoke box, you know, we can't discuss around the machines. So I said, well, let's have a look at it, because I could see the danger of a black strike with the whites in. So I said, we're not against fighting, because we'd already had two strikes over Asians being sacked for fighting each other. Because it's the machinery and the noise and the heat that makes you irritable, where you're liable to have fights. So we're not against fighting. If you don't want to get thumped, don't get up people's noses. We're not against people calling them bastards. You know, we use strong language in the class. But when somebody says black, they're dividing us, because some are black and some are white. You know, so they're attacking our unity. So they're not only attacking the blacks, they're attacking the whites, because they're dividing us with saying something like that. So this guy, obviously, it was like somebody saying white bastard. You know, it's racial, so we've got to step on it. We've got to say to Pike, unless he apologises to all the shifts for trying to divide us by coming out with this racial remark, then we'll not work with him. And if he comes on the floor, we'll stop. So, after 3 hours' argument, this was agreed on. So it was put to Pike, and Pike apologised to all three shifts. But, I mean, it saved us from this race track, which would have been very dangerous, you know. I mean, the front had really moved in, and we'd have had all sorts of stuff coming in. And it would have undone everything that we'd... And the blacks saw what I was getting at, see, and they saw the dangers of the thing then. So we overcome that, and also it disciplined the leader of the front cell. They knew they couldn't get away with everything.